Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for January 2014. You know, each year when I introduce a new year, it seems quite remarkable to me, given that we've now been doing this going on 32 years. It just strikes me as both amazing how quickly time goes by, but also the breadth and depth of material that has gone on over these 30 plus years as it relates to the evolution of medicine. I was reminded of this when I read just this last week a very interesting report from the University of Washington School of Medicine. Two geneticists have just determined that there is a code that lies underneath the genetic code that we all learned from the Watson and Crick days and the early 1960s, things that I committed to memory for tests that I took in the early 60s when I went to college. And now we find out that there's another code that lay dormant, quiet, stealthily below the code that we all had learned that actually informs how the other code is going to be read, meaning it's a code within a code. Now think of the implication of what this means for just the advancing understanding of genetics. We think we know so much, and we do know a lot, but yet there is so much we don't know. And this, of course, is what separates the sophomoric wise fool from the individual who was always on the seeking and frontier of new knowledge, knowing that what they knew yesterday may be replaced by something they learn tomorrow that actually revolutionizes thinking. And that's exactly what we're going to be confronted with here in the first two issues of the 2014 year of Functional Medicine Update. You are going to be privileged, as I was privileged, to be informed by two world leaders in the area of gastrointestinal health from a perspective that I would call remarkable, game-changing, groundbreaking, paradigm-shifting, revolutionary. It's almost, however, back to the future because it takes us back to some of the early reports of people like Ilya Mechnikov, who at the turn of the last century was speaking about prolongation of life by the installation of lactobulgaricus forms of bacteria into the rectum for reinstilling proper bacterial flora into the gut for health, the prolongation of life, or consuming orally various forms of yogurt or kefir that were cultured products that had these live bacteria for improvement of health. And of course, this was ridiculed for so many decades as being facetious, silly, nonsensical, non-scientific, artifactual, and all sorts of words, some less complimentary than others, that would marginalize this concept, saying that it was a thought without proof. But as you will learn through the lens of two extraordinary investigators, Dr. Alessio Fasano at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Gasparini, arguably one of the top gastroenterologists in Italy, who will be our February Functional Medicine Update Clinician of the Month, Researcher of the Month, you're going to learn that what was old is new, that we have actually been able to start understanding this complex interrelationship between our diet, our living microbes in our gut, the so-called microbiome, and our systemic health, to the point that it's leading to a whole revolution in thinking about the origin of chronic illness and both how to prevent and manage it, and also to understand the epidemiological epidemic that we're seeing, almost a pandemic globally, of the rising tide of chronic illness as we start seeing changes in diet, changes in environmental pollution, changes in stress patterns, and how that translates into just a virtual pandemic of incidence of diseases that used to be relegated to a small fraction of the population at the terminal end of their life. And now we're seeing it start to penetrate down into younger years with greater prevalency. Things like type 2 diabetes, neurologic, nephropathic, ocular injury, dementia, cardiovascular disease, dyslipidemias, inflammatory conditions, arthritis, autoimmune disease, digestive disorders of a nonspecific origin. All of these, which we see as changing patterns of health, are interrelated to this extraordinary paradigm-shifting revolution and understanding that we're being confronted with, that you'll learn more about from our clinicians of the month, our researchers of the month, in these, what I would call, epic January and February issues, 2014, a Functional Medicine Update. So jump on the train. We're just about ready to leave the station, and you're going to be having a really interesting journey with us over the next 2 months. So with that, let's turn our attention to one of the world's foremost experts in what we consider gluten-related dysfunctions, Dr. Alessio Fasano, and get some direction from him as it relates to this transition, transformation that's occurring in thinking. And then we'll come back and regroup and have some thoughts after his discussion.
We are fortunate to have as our Clinician Researcher of the Month an individual who is arguably, I believe, probably the top or one of the top rated presenters that we have ever seen at the Institute for Functional Medicine International Symposia over the last 23 years. For those of you that were at the meeting, you know who I'm speaking to, and that is Dr. Alessio Fasano, whose name and reputation really precedes him. It's remarkable to see what Dr. Fasano has done in terms of opening up this field of understanding of this complexity between food and the immune system through the interaction of certain reactive proteins in food that are members of the family that we call gluten, but then really beyond that to this whole threshold issue of how information in food can be picked up by the immune system of the body and translated on an individual basis based on genetic uniqueness into information that would be considered alarm information that we often call disorders of inflammation or autoimmunity. And I think we have had a lot of history of working around this topic, but we've never had the privilege until the last 10 or 15 years of having someone of the insight, precision, and doing the heavy lifting in science of a Dr. Fasano to really add substance to the understanding of this topic. Alessio, it's wonderful to have you here. You're, I know, extraordinarily busy in your position there as the director of the Center for Celiac Research at Mass General Hospital and being a visiting professor at Harvard Med School in pediatrics and publishing widely, engaged in research and grant writing, and really, I would have to say, being a central feature in changing the context of medicine to really look seriously at how nutrition, diet, and reactive substances in food influence health. So thank you for being part of our Functional Medicine Update.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me. They're very flattering words.
Well, certainly well-deserved. For those of the listeners that were not fortunate enough to hear you speak, which, by the way, was one of the most eloquent presentations I've had the fortune of hearing, where you talked about the research method and the development of a hypothesis and what led you down the trail into this extraordinary detective story surrounding gluten and celiac disease. Maybe for our listeners that were not so fortunate to be there, you could give a brief overview of how you traveled through your intellectual journey from Italy to North Carolina to Maryland and to the Mucosal Disease Research Center and ultimately now over to Mass General, as just how your intellectual process evolved.
Sure. I mean, this is sort of serendipity as usual. When I was a medical student, I was very much interested in diarrheal diseases. While I was in training, I joined a lab that was a strong lab in terms of diarrheal diseases and gut physiology. And I studied for several years how the intestine really reacts when attacked by a microorganism that can cause diarrhea. And then I reached the point in which I felt that I knew one side of the coin. I need to know a little bit more of the other side, what bacteria they do in order to crosstalk with the host. And so my mentor suggested me to spend a couple months in the United States to learn a little bit about bacteria pathogenesis, and particularly cholera. That was the pathogen that I was very much interested in because it was still causing tremendous amount of morbidity and mortality in the population. And he sent me to Baltimore at the Center for Vaccine Development to spend a couple months there. And this couple months became 2 years because I was at the right place at the right time with the right people. And several discoveries were made, so that became quite an exciting time of my professional career. And after these 2 years, I had to go back to finish up my fellowship and to wrap it up what I was doing in Italy. This was in the late 80s. And by October 1992, I got a phone call from the department chair of pediatrics in Maryland, said, "We want you to come back and for good to be our division chief." Talk about a total shift of lifestyle. My English was still, broken English, and I didn't know anything about the rules of medical practice in the United States. I didn't even have a visa, but bottom line, I decided to jump on this opportunity at a relatively young age. I was in my mid-30s, and in 1993, I moved for good. And from there, I started this journey from the diarrheal diseases, try to understand how pathogens crosstalk with us, and try to understand what are the mechanisms they engage. And interestingly enough, not because by design, but because science brought me from one point to another, this kind of discoveries led to better understanding of the interplay between the host and the environment that leads to autoimmunity. And celiac disease that was already clinical interest of mine, it became a unique model to study this interplay in terms of autoimmunity. And the rest is history.
Yeah, I think that the rest is history is so fascinating to watch the evolution of your publications. I've had the privilege, I can't say I've read all the more than 200 of your publications, but I've read, I think, a critical number of them to get the ebb and flow, the texture of your work. And you can actually, I think, by following your publications, almost do a history of the evolution of gut immunology and this complex interaction between the microbiome, the gut enteric immune system, and the diet. And I think through your own work, we're actually seeing the evolution of a historical paradigm shift in medicine. Have you had support from your colleagues in the broader gastroenterological field for what is a remarkable perspective of change in thinking about the GI system and its relationship to the gut bacteria and the diet?
Well, Jeff, there are two kinds of science, I believe. There's the incremental science, so that you go from point A to point B, from point B to point C, and so on and so forth. So you know where you're starting and you know where you're leading to. This is a science that in general is supported by peers because they see it. They understand what you're trying to do. And in general, you do this incremental science by relying on what has been out there in terms of the literature. So it's their own work that is cited, that is the basis of what you're doing and so on. So that is the accepted kind of path. And then there is transformational science. The ones that it really is a total shift of paradigm, thinking out of the box. The stuff that it's a high risk because most of the time you're wrong, but if you're right, you change completely the landscape, you open different kind of avenues. By definition, this is not that popular because you go against wisdom, or you go against the establishment, and it's a little bit more complicated and hard to be accepted. Not because of design, because I didn't decide that way, but most of my scientific career has been transformational science because I stumbled upon it. And therefore, I really had a hard time. I can list many times in which, for example, start with the celiac disease when we start to claim that was not rare, it was believed to be in the United States, but was overlooked. I can't tell you how many times people criticize their point of view to the point in which some of my close friends and colleagues said, what are you doing to yourself? You're ruining your reputation and therefore your career. I mean, why you do this to yourself? And again, it turns to be that indeed that was the story, and nobody will even dispute that celiac disease exists in the United States. Same story in terms of autoimmunity. For example, the general wisdom that is still hold true to many classical immunologists is that autoimmunity is a one-way street. Once you got in there, you can't come back because it's totally irreversible. There is nothing you can do about it because the results of antigen mimicry or bystander effects, so you lose the capability to tolerate something, and there is no way that you can rewind the tape. And celiac disease suggests otherwise, that if you really can block this interplay between the host and the environment, and in celiac disease we know the environmental trigger, so you can really do that, you can stop autoimmunity. So this was a completely shift of paradigm that was really not well accepted, and now I believe most of the people would not dispute that. And then when we, and probably was the most complicated part of the story, when we put into the picture of the recipe of autoimmunity, a third ingredient, besides the genetic predisposition, environmental trigger, namely the loss of intestinal barrier function, so that intestine can keep out the quote-unquote enemies, i.e. the non-self antigens that will instigate the immune system to lead to autoimmunity, that was another major shift of paradigm that created major outsource of criticisms, because of course many colleagues say now you're embracing the leaky gut theory that is bogus, it's not true, and so on and so forth. And, you know, again, in all these examples, you can just express your opinion based off your honest, humble observation, because what a scientist does is not invent anything or discover anything. It just listens to nature, because the stuff is already written. So either you're a good listener or not. If you're a good listener, and therefore, rather than to try to force nature your mental preconcept, you just are there to serve what is already out there, the chance exists that all the time, even if at the beginning you will have a really hard time, the facts will speak for you and not my opinion versus yours. And again, all these examples that I gave you, why when we proposed that kind of shift of paradigm, we were not well accepted. Then the evidence in the literature and the accumulation of data became so overwhelmingly clear that I think that nobody will dispute again that autoimmunity requires three elements, including the intestinal barrier dysfunction, that the autoimmune process is not a one-way process anymore, but if you can find a way to stop this interplay between environment and host, you can do that, and you can really bring back these people, that there is definitely an element that is crucial, that has changed the environment to explain these epidemics in the past 50 years of autoimmune diseases, then nutrition is probably the key elements that change everything together without a few. And this impinge on the composition, the microbiome that seems really to dictate the yin and yang between tolerance and immune response in people who are genetically predisposed. So all this concept that were at the forefront of out-of-the-box thinking, I believe now are coming in the mainstream pipeline of thoughts, and we're glad.
Let me take a deep emotional and intellectual breath with the listener here. I think every sentient human being that just listened to what you said over this last few minutes, which was so eloquent and so word efficient in projecting many, many thoughts about the evolution of ideas, the change of culture, discovery, innovation, reduction of human suffering, that was all incorporated so eloquently in your previous thoughts. And I hope every one of us listening are taking this in, because it's a model for how humans progress in time and culture and overcome barriers of static thinking and produce a dynamic change in society. I'm reminded that this hinges on the scholarship of your work, because in the end, the more revolutionary the discoveries, the more it requires the diligence or the heavy lifting of proof of concept, which you've done very, very nicely through exquisite science. And your discovery of zonulin and the interrelationship of these interesting proteins that are messenger molecules that interrelate gastrointestinal environment to systemic responses, and things like how calprotectin interrelates with the barrier function of the gut and how that connects to zonulin. These are all new concepts that have come out of your laboratory. Was it a consequence of you bringing into your laboratory individuals with diverse talents that helped to make discoveries out of the area of the common path? Or did you yourself travel into these uncharted waters to find out how to explore these processes?
Oh, Jeff, this kind of science would require a team and not a single individual. The single individual can come up with intuition, but you know, it takes a village. So by all means, whatever we accomplish is the consequence of a team of dedicated individuals that share the kind of vision. I mean, I personally believe that if you want to do good science, you have to have very clear in mind what is the ultimate goal. And in my experience, if your ultimate goal is career, success, fame, you're going to fail because you are blind to what is really the ultimate goal. If the ultimate goal is to improve quality of life for people and try to understand why people eventually move from a state of health to a state of disease, then the fame, the discoveries, that will become as a part of a collateral, not a primary goal. Now, the key elements is to choose the team that see the same way that you see. And that's the only thing that I did. So in other words, I may not have had my lab as collaborators maybe 10 Nobel Prizes, but definitely I had people that were embracing the same concept of what is our ultimate goal, not seeking fame or money or God knows what, promotion and grants, but make sure that we never get distracted from what is our final destination. And this brings also to some interesting facts about dichotomies that I still don't understand. For example, traditional medicine versus complementary medicine, functional medicine versus evidence-based medicine. I just don't get it. And again, these are polarized point of view that I believe are making a disservice to what is indeed our final mission here. Because I'm pretty sure that a functional medicine doctor and a classical trained traditional doctor, they have the same kind of final goal. It's the methodology that changed, maybe, but not definitely the goal. And I don't understand why one has to be right and by default the other one has to be wrong. If you look at just the history of medicine and discoveries, Chinese medicine, Tibetan medicine, Arabian medicine, the Greek and Romans, they were healers. So they were taking care of the single individual. And over time, we decided that we have to make rules because otherwise you cannot really come up with some intelligible explanation what is the phenomena that we look at. And therefore, we moved to the large numbers, the epidemiological studies, the evidence base, the algorithms, i.e. the way that we now function. And we made this kind of rules because we assume that there is homogeneity in a disease. When you talk about serious disease, we talk about the same thing, and therefore the assumption is that the approach has to be the same, the solution has to be the same, no matter who you are. And now we realize that we were wrong. And indeed, now we move to the next phase in which everybody would agree that personalized medicine, patient stratification for customized approach is the way to go. So what is the difference between these two worlds? I don't see it. It's just in a matter of methodology.
Yeah, very well said. So I want to give you a gift just quickly, and I know you get these gifts all the time, which are feedback from patients who have benefited from these aha moments that you've helped provide them. We had two leaders, clinical leaders, interviewed on Functional Medicine Update years ago about their own personal experiences, what I would call the classic aha personal experience with their own health issues that tied back to discoveries that they made in themselves thanks to you. These two individuals both spoke about the fact that they had developed progressively more serious neurological issues, one leading to multiple miscarriages and very serious musculoskeletal disability. They were in an academic setting as a faculty member and seeing the best of their colleagues, not finding remediation. And then they happened to come onto your work. They went on to a gluten-restricted diet. And within about a year, they completely recovered their health. This woman went on to successfully have a child after these multiple miscarriages, who now, by the way, it's enough years that that child has turned out to be a star student and is going to go on to medical school, and credits her life in finding your work. And that same issue of Functional Medicine Update, another clinician, a doctor in private practice in this case, was a woman who started to develop a nonspecific kind of encephalomyelitis. It looked like she was becoming demented. She was losing her memory, losing her language skills, really seriously. Thought it was MS, but it really wasn't MS. Just couldn't come to a clean diagnosis. Was unable to drive her car, had to give up her practice, and then found your work through someone who suggested that maybe this work of Dr. Fasano might apply to her situation. She went on a gluten-free diet and again talks about her story in this interview, which has completely transformed her life, put her back on the path to good health, and transformed her practice now in New Hampshire, where that's her focus, is dealing with this problem with patients. So this translational concept from the lab to the bench, from the bench to the bedside, to the clinic, to the individual, this is something that very few people in research ever get a chance to see. It must give you a great sense of joy to actually see these discoveries you're making actually make such a meaningful difference in people's lives.
Well, Jeff, first of all, I sincerely appreciate that you share these stories because we live for this kind of stuff. The purpose of science without applicability really doesn't really satisfy or give you the sense of accomplishment. But when your science really makes a difference in the life of individuals, even a single one, that is worth any kind of price that you can imagine, because that's really the kind of legacy that I personally believe that will make sense and justify the tremendous amount of work and sacrifice that you do in embracing this kind of profession. we talk about the result that you publish and the success, but for each one that you publish, there are hundreds and hundreds of experiments that didn't go well. I keep telling my students and fellows, I say, the best trait that predictors of a good scientist is perseverance, because you need to delay rewards. It doesn't come right away. But when you have stories like the ones you just shared with me, I mean, these are priceless. I can't really put the right value, face value, to what this means. And again, studying a molecule like gluten, it's a protein from a grain that supposedly is supposed to be a friend, and trying to make a sense why these friends become a foe has been quite an extraordinary journey for us. And again, it's a shift of paradigm when we start really to find out that this is creating problem not just for people who see the disease, but everybody. We get hammered by our colleagues. What are you talking about? The only way that you can get in trouble with gluten is celiac disease. And if you don't have celiac disease, there is no reason to even consider a gluten-free diet or to do anything about it. And then over the years, we realized something that I found extremely fascinating, that gluten is treated by our immune system as a component of our microorganisms. So in other words, induce the same immune response that we will have if we're being exposed to a bacterium. And as such, we see this response that it's common to everybody. And then again, this must be the consequence that gluten was a mistake of evolution. We were not supposed to eat this protein because it came into the picture only in the last second of the 2.5 million years of humankind of evolution with the advent of agriculture 10,000 years ago. And again, I believe that like bacteria, even if everybody, when exposed to them, they have an immune reaction, not everybody develop an infection. So not everybody eat gluten will get sick because of ingesting it. The vast majority, matter of fact, will eventually fight this enemy through the immune system and will not even know this fight was occurring. It's a few that lose the battle that will eventually develop problems like the outcome that is celiac disease or the allergic reaction like with allergy or like these two examples you just gave of the non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
So you just authored a fascinating paper that's co-authored with many of your colleagues, which I find just philosophically interesting. It's entitled Non-Celiac Gluten Sensitivity, The New Frontier of Gluten-Related Disorders. It appeared in the journal Nutrients in 2013, volume 5, page 3839. It's a very powerful review, but it's also very interesting philosophically because the co-authors on this paper represent leaders in their field across many countries, Italy, France, Spain, Germany, Buenos Aires in Argentina, United States, Columbia University. This is a tour de force. Tell us a little bit about how this article actually was put together with these multiple authors.
Well, again, because there is very few facts and a lot of fantasies, we designed that the best way to make the point of where is the current situation on non-celiac gluten sensitivity was to really put around the table the who is who about celiac disease and gluten-related disorders. And Jeff, nevertheless to say, this was a very interesting exercise because there were believers and not believers, traditional thinkers and progressive thinkers. And these 2 days of brainstorming around the table of these 30-plus people, coming indeed from every corner of the world, was an open-mind experience for me that I was moderating the discussion. And again, you can see how during these 2 days, you start with this preconcept and walls of consideration about the topic and why discussing this wall came down. And people start to really open up to constructive possibilities to try to understand what are the facts and what are the fantasies. And the result of that is that review that you just mentioned, that indeed is a scientific review, but also a philosophical testament, if you wish, of what is a critical thinking of an open mind approach to a topic that is fascinating, to say the least. I don't think that anybody, even the most skeptical, will doubt the existence of this new entity. And again, this was something that we put forward 3 or 4 years ago with a couple of papers that proved that this was different from celiac disease. This news were not accepted that well from the establishment, but now even some of them reluctantly, but they are to admit that they exist. Now, what exactly this is all about is still object of discussion. And that's what I believe the pipeline of research will materialize over the years. I was skeptical myself, but when we have examples as the one that you mentioned of these two colleagues, there is no way that you can support the notion if you don't have celiac disease, you don't have business to go on a gluten-free diet. How you justify this tremendous improvement of symptoms that people they experience for so long just going on a gluten-free diet without having that open-mindedness that there is something beyond celiac disease that can bother people when exposed to gluten? And that's pretty much what materialized in this consensus conference that led to this publication.
So I want to spend the last couple moments, if I can, with you, crossing a very interesting bridge that I know you're crossing or have crossed. I'd like to vicariously cross this with you for a moment, and that is you have chosen in your life to take on two extraordinarily dominant paradigms that have a lot of what I would call intellectual sclerosis associated with them, one of which is autoimmune disease, which you very gracefully talked about, this shifting paradigm that maybe it's a two-way street and environment and genes interact in a way that can go both ways, meaning remission plus progression. That's a pretty remarkable concept in and of itself. And now you have crossed another bridge, and I'll just cite three recent papers that you're an author of that illustrates this bridge. It's part of this overall theme, but it's certainly taking on another level of visibility. And those three papers include your 2012 paper, The Expression of Caspases is Enhanced in Peripheral Blood Mononuclear Cells of Autistic Spectrum Disorder Patients, that appeared in the Journal of Autistic Development Disorders in 2012. And then the paper, Gastrointestinal Conditions in Children with Autistic Spectrum Disorder, Developing a Research Agenda, that was in Pediatrics in 2012. And then most recently, Cannabinoid Receptor Type 2 but not Type 1 Upregulated in Peripheral Blood Mononuclear Cells of Children Affected by Autistic Disorders in the Journal of Autistic Development Disorders. This is, as we both know, and you are a pediatric gastroenterologist, so you know it much better than I, is a very colored area as a consequence of the work of Andrew Wakefield, who has gotten himself obviously into some muddied water over his purported discoveries in England of this relationship between what he called ileal nodular hyperplasia and autistic spectrum disorder. So I'm wondering, as you have moved across this bridge with such precision and such science, how you've managed the legacy of what might be considered colored information in this area.
Well, Jeff, you put that in a very polite way, but this is a very hidden, extremely controversial field of the role of the gastrointestinal tract in autism spectrum disorders. And again, this was an unfortunate situation in which it doesn't matter which part of the fence you are, that created tremendous confusion in the field, distrust on the topic, and who ultimately paid the price have been the patients. That saw a deceleration of science that really put the entire field on halt. What are the facts? The fact is that I don't think anybody disputes there is an axis that puts in touch and crosstalk gut with the brain. That's pretty much a concept that everybody now accepts. There is a brain-gut axis, and this applies not just to autism, but applies to schizophrenia, applies to multiple sclerosis, and so on and so forth. There is some basic science to explain the mechanisms that are engaged in a situation in which you have an inflammation in the gut that eventually will affect the behavior of individuals. And now specifically as concerning the autistic kids, again, I was pretty much brought into the picture by force by some people in the autistic community because they honestly appreciated that there is some involvement with the gut. There's been this unfortunate situation that I don't think that we need to revisit. And they decided rather to ignore the possibility that the gut has anything to do with autism, it was to start all over again in doing this right. And therefore, with the understanding that my expertise in autism is extremely limited, and I admitted this right away to these people that asked me to give my opinion, I had the opportunity also, in a very unbiased way, take a look at the situation, and I found this fascinating. And everybody agrees that autism it's a situation that you can develop by a different means. In other words, metabolic disorders, genetic problems, you can have metal exposure. I believe that joints of vaccination can be involved, definitely food intolerances and so on and so forth. So everybody agreed there are different paths that can bring you to your final destination. Yet everybody was looking for a single magic bullet that will fix them all. That, for me, is counterintuitive. And there are different theories, not mutually exclusive, why people may eventually develop autism through a GI-initiated process. For example, for food intolerance, going back to gluten, people believe that some of these fragments are not digested, they mimic endorphins across the intestine barrier because leaks and goes through the blood-brain barrier and interact with the receptor endorphins and make these people change behavior and then on specific genetic background translate in autism. There are theories of what is called the neuroinflammation. You know, first step with gluten and digested fragments, and this will create an immune response, and then the cells that fight this enemy are activated so they can create inflammation, but somehow they are programmed to leave the intestine and to reach as the final destination, the brain, on a specific regions, create neuroinflammation that leads to autism. And this second theory now is the one that I'm following more closely because of these results of the papers that you just mentioned seem to point toward this neuroinflammatory theory. I find fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And again, the instigator can be gluten, can be a virus, can be a bacterium, can be a metal, whatever, but there is somehow that these immune cells that are on the battlefield of the intestine, they are supposed to protect us against these enemies, they are programmed to go to the brain. Who makes this decision? How they are programmed? Why they go in a part of the brain rather than another? And why there is different outcomes? Because the same mechanism for autism applies to schizophrenia and depression and chronic fatigue syndromes. These are the same cells that go there, maybe different regions of the brain, and on a different genetic background, you have a different clinical outcome. I find this effect of neuroinflammation instigated by response at the level of the gut immune system extremely fascinating and very, very difficult to tackle. But I think you need to go step by step and start to ask a specific question and see if you can have specific answers.
Well, that was, once again, you have such an extraordinary gift in summarizing and bringing together a huge amount of information in a very concise way. And I just wanted to pass on, once again, our deep respect and admiration for your courage. I think this is not an easy area politically to work in. It requires the best of science to convince sclerosed minds that there may be something on the other side that they didn't take advantage of trying to understand and were unconscious to. I'm thinking of an MD, PhD from Belgium who's published extensively about work associated with depression and chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia related to gut barrier problems and metabolic endotoxemia, or Patrice Connie and Nathalie Delzen at Catholic University Louvain and the work that they show with endotoxemia and in association with neurotoxicity. So there's an emerging family of colleagues that you share the universe with that are all very courageous, good scientists, good observers that are creating the new medicine. And just as one small observer in this world, I want to give thanks to you for what you're doing for your team. I hope you'll thank them on behalf of us at Functional Medicine Update and continue the extraordinary work, because it's the quality of the work that will ultimately change the people's minds.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your kind work. And again, on behalf of the entire team, we'll appreciate your help and support and the fact that you see the value of what we're doing. I want to stress once again, the entire team works towards the goal to improve quality of life for people, nothing else. And as far as we reach those goals, even if we have been wrong, so the B will be delighted to say that we were wrong, provided that, again, we move the field forward.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fasano. We wish you the very, very best, and be assured we're going to keep in close touch with what's going on with your laboratory.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Well, I hope that you took away from that which I did, Dr. Fasano's insight, his dedication to excellence, and his courage as it relates to bending the curve or changing the perspective or sharpening the lens or creating a new focus. These are not easy things for anyone to do in the face of dominant thinking and clubs and guilds that preserve the old and are resistant to the new.
but I believe that truth has its own vector. It ultimately wills out. It may take some time to work its way through the system, but it ultimately creates its own outcome of a new sense of reality. And I believe that you can see with the degree of care and fastidiousness and attention to detail and excellence in science that Dr. Bassano is bringing to his work, that these discoveries are going to have their way in leveraging us to a new paradigm in healthcare. And it will, I believe, have significant impact on managing many complex disorders that have previously been without good understanding of therapy, in which at best we've been managing the symptoms rather than the cause. Now, as you probably recognize, this concept of non-celiac gluten sensitivity is a controversial area because all gastroenterologists would, I believe, if they were reasonably trained, would say there is such thing as gastropathology associated with gluten sensitivity in individuals who are genetically at risk. So that non-tropical sprue or celiac disease is nothing new. And in fact, if they're recently educated, they would also say that these conditions are a part of the autoimmune family. Now, if we just took that for a second, just what I've said there, which I think is the most non-controversial thing I could take out of Dr. Fasano's presentation, that there's something in food that certain genetically sensitive individuals translate into an autoimmune disease that gets a name, a so-called diagnostic determinant, called a CPT code celiac disease. That's a very powerful paradigm-shifting concept, isn't it? Because we consider food, I believe, to be a source of nutrients, providing calories, micronutrients, other bioactive ingredients that modulate human function. We don't normally think of food necessarily as containing things that, for one, could be considered beneficial, but that same food for another could be considered a toxin. Such a toxin that it actually activates the immune system to produce a disease within the family that we call autoimmune disease that shares the like with multiple sclerosis and things like rheumatoid arthritis and systemic lupus erythematosus and myasthenia gravis. And, you know, there are 88 different conditions, thyroiditis like Hashimoto's thyroiditis. The laundry list of these diseases is quite large. So what we're saying here is that a principle in food that for one individual, maybe the majority of individuals, would be considered a positive constitutional component, meaning it's a protein material that could be used beneficially by being broken down by digestion and those amino acids become available for reconstruction into the body's native proteins. In the case of others, this is considered such a foreign ingredient that it activates the immune system in those genetically unique individuals to produce a secondary effect that we label as an autoimmune disease, which for decades went without known etiology. Well, I think that these are pretty remarkable conceptual changes in thinking. If you give it a moment to let that wash over your nervous system, you say, whoa, just a minute. Food of one poison another. Doesn't this go all the way back to the future to Hippocrates? And aren't we really kind of learning the science that was maybe known empirically by observation for a long period of time? Non-celiac gluten sensitivity, then, is the next step of this, isn't it? Because what Dr. Fasano and his colleagues are saying is it's not just only presented through this classic gastropathology that we call celiac disease, but there are forms of this condition that translates into autoimmunity that is not associated with gastropathology, but rather systemic neurological problems and immunological problems. Now, that's taking the next step in this model, this paradigm. Now, if you think of this then as a sequence of increasing severities or complexity, you'll notice that there is probably no such thing as the primacy of a pure disease. It exists in different forms and different variations. It has different etiological contributors. It has genetically different sensitivities or susceptibilities in different people to different components of it, some which may present with much more overt pathology that's easy to recognize, like bleeding intestines, and others may be much more complex and difficult to understand the etiology, like joint pain or dementia, which it's hard to trace it right back to, well, gee whiz, I ate wheat all those years. I didn't know that was really creating my problem. The direct line of sight is pretty complex. There's a lot of things in the way between eating that food and having that dementia over years, because it doesn't come on immediately. It may take decades and decades and decades of living before these things are presented. So this is what you probably heard as long latency diseases. And these are conditions that don't come on as an immediate consequence of something that we've been exposed to, like a food poisoning, but really come on as a consequence of long latency conditions. So I think that we then talk about, is this a genetic or an epigenetic effect? Does it have transmissible influences to the second and third generations, like a transgenerational effect? These are extraordinary new paradigms within the field of nutrition, biomedicine, and healthcare that really have been seen on the frontier only for the last decade or so as serious. But they tie back to things that were brought up all the way back to Hippocrates and probably before into Ayurvedic medicine, these observational connections. Now, with that in mind, Dr. Fasano described in his discussion with me this very interesting paper that's multi-authored that appeared in the journal Nutrients in 2013, volume 5, page 35-38, which is entitled Non-Celiac Gluten Sensitivity, the New Frontier of Gluten-Related Disorders. And I find this interesting because the authors that all signed on to this article include high-positioned individuals in academic medicine from Italy, from France, from the United States, from internal medicine in Germany. So we're looking at a group of cooperative experts who have recognized that there's something more to this condition called gluten sensitivity than just celiac disease. And I find it very, very extraordinary when you start thinking of what it takes to shift the paradigm. What's the critical mass of opinion leaders before it becomes a standard of understanding? And I don't think there's a hard and fast rule, but I can say that if you have a paper appearing a journal that's a tier one journal and it's authored by 25 different high experts from 12 different countries, it starts to raise the visibility of this as being more than just an N of one, just one person's opinion. So the abstract of this article, I think you'll find very interesting. I'll just quote it for you because I think it does establish the tone of where this field is going. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity was originally described in the late 1980s. I want to, again, talk about timing. Late 1980s. So we're talking about 30 years, right, of investigation. And it was rediscovered, disorder characterized by intestinal and extraintestinal symptoms. And I want to emphasize extraintestinal, meaning systemic symptoms, not just locally regional to the gut, related to the ingestion of gluten-containing food in subjects that are not affected with either celiac disease or wheat allergy. So they would not test positive for celiac by a normal biopsy, and they would not have what we call wheat allergy by traditional IgE testing. Although non-celiac gluten sensitivity frequency is still unclear, epidemiological data have been generated that can help establishing the magnitude of this problem. So if we assume that celiac disease is less than 1% of the population, you might say, well, how frequent is non-celiac gluten sensitivity? An overlap between the irritable bowel syndrome and the non-celiac gluten sensitivity has been detected, requiring even more stringent diagnostic criteria. Several studies suggest a relationship between these and neuropsychiatric disorders. So now we've implicated the brain and subtle effects on memory, mood, cognition, and affect, basically. Particularly autism and schizophrenia. Oh, now we're really cutting across medical disciplines, aren't we? We're really kind of mixing country club memberships as we move into the neurology and the psychiatric fields. The first case reports of non-celiac gluten sensitivity in children have been described. The problem is that there's still lack of biomarkers. That's a major limitation for these clinical studies, making it difficult to differentiate non-celiac gluten sensitivity from other gluten-related disorders. Recent studies raise the possibility that beside gluten, and here's a very important part, beside gluten, wheat amylase trypsin inhibitors and low fermentable, poorly absorbed, short chain carbohydrates can contribute to symptoms, at least those related to IBS, experienced by the non-celiac gluten sensitivity patients. Now, what's that mean in English? Well, I think you all know that it's taking us beyond just a traditional food allergy concept. It's taking us just between gluten as the culprit. And remember, gluten is a generic name for a whole range of proteins that are in that family of glutinous proteins. They have electrophoretic patterns that are similar, but they have slightly different amino acid compositions. Beyond that of these gluten family members, however, there may be other constituents in grain-based products, particularly genetically hybridized grain-based products, I might add, that have things like wheat amylase trypsin inhibitors, digestive enzyme inhibitors, and low fermentable, poorly absorbed short chain carbohydrates. These are polyols and other kinds of carbohydrates for which there is an immune response at the gastrointestinal mucosal cell, suggesting an alarm reaction. By the way, this ties directly together with the therapeutic benefit that many patients have had with these nonspecific problems by going on to what's called the FODMAPS program. You recall the FODMAPS is this very interesting low polyol, low simple carbohydrate, and this includes certain fruits and vegetables that contain these carbohydrates, that then is seen as very beneficial for people with nonspecific gastrointestinal symptomatology. But it may also cut across other symptomatologies, including systemic inflammatory conditions and neurologic conditions that are associated with this non-celiac gluten sensitivity situation. So we're broadening the range of our understanding of food of one poison for another, aren't we? We're now moving into saying, whoa, just a minute, it's not so obvious just to look at the immediate pathology of the gut. We have to start asking, what is the relationship between that food to the sensitive antennae that stick out on our gut mucosa that pick up information from my digestant and convert it into immunological and neurological messages that are seen throughout the whole body? This is a paradigm-shifting concept. I mean, I can't even begin to amplify how significant this really is, because as we have modified our food supply system over the last several generations, we have assumed that these genetic hybrids, and I'm not just talking about GMO, I'm talking about traditional hybridization through inbreeding of plants, has resulted in certain beneficial characteristics, but it's also changed the protein content of these foods and introduce different carbohydrates into these foods. Because when you start mixing genes, you get all sorts of interesting secondary effects, which don't look like they're bad. I mean, you feed the products to animals, they seem fine, and they grow up and they do well. But over the course of time, in a genetically heterogeneous population, some of those changes that occur in those structures may, in fact, induce alarm reaction in certain people based upon their genes. And this is a whole different view of toxicology, isn't it? Because when we look at toxicology in a traditional sense, we think of it as immediate poisoning. And so we look at the LD50s, like what's the lethal dose that would kill 50% of the animals. Here we're looking at very subtle immunological and neurological toxicity that may not occur in the immediacy, but it may occur over decades of living. And as the immune system of individuals, as they age changes, may make them more sensitive or susceptible to those alterations that have occurred in their diet. So it's a very complex matrix. It's not easily pieced apart looking at one person or one group of people against one changing variable like we do with a drug with an RCT, a randomized clinical trial, where we take one molecule, a drug, and give it to 10,000 people and look at the effect against a placebo. Here we're looking at the subtle effects on a population-based basis of a heterogeneous genealogy against multiple changes that have occurred in our food supply system, and then they start popping up as diseases that seem like they're unique, for which we can find no explanation. That's the model that we're looking at here as it relates to these, what we would call non-celiac gluten sensitivity-related conditions. So I think that this article that appeared in Nutrients, which Dr. Fasano was one of the principal authors, is extraordinarily important and well worth the review. Now, taking that a step farther, you might start saying, well, how do these things actually work if they're altering immune system function? What are these antennae you're talking about, and what's being activated on these antennae? And we've talked a lot over the years about the so-called GALT, the gastrointestinal-associated lymphoid tissue, and the MALT, M-A-L-T, the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, and how these are cell types that have membrane surface receptors that pick up messages from the external environment, meaning the gastrointestinal system, and are activated in the presence of certain ligands, meaning binding substances, to translate that message into altered cellular function, which then transmits that message by releasing from those cells certain kinds of mediators that can be interleukins or cytokines or regulatory substances that go downstream then in the blood supply to affect the receptors on other cell types which have similar lineage, like the Kupffer cells in the liver or the mast cells or the macrophages of the monocytes that then influence the receptor sites on the surface of the glial cells in the brain. And suddenly we get a systemic effect where this relay race of information is being transmitted from one cell line, similar background or genealogy, to another cell line. So that particular model assumes then that there is some known mechanism of an activated receptor that is activated or modified in its function in the presence of those agents that we find in this altered diet. And again, I come back to Dr. Fasano and his colleagues at the Department of Experimental Medicine, and this is collaborative work that he's done with the Second University of Naples, are what are called the cannabinoid receptors. Now, cannabinoid receptors, interestingly enough, were named after tetrahydrocannabinoids, the active principles in marijuana. It's not as if suddenly the body evolved marijuana receptor need. It's just that we name them based on their pharmacological target, which I find interesting. So what we call the cannabinoid receptor is certainly doing much more than just waiting for marijuana. These are endocannabinoids that are produced by the body. These are various compounds that the body naturally produces that activates and regulates these pleasure centers that influence cellular function. Now, these cannabinoid receptors are part of what's called the G-protein-coupled receptor family. And the G-protein-coupled receptors, you probably recall, are transmembrane receptors, seven transmembrane loops that basically pick up information from the outside environment. And there are over 100 different members of this family of receptor types, and they pick up olfactants, and they pick up flavorants, and they pick up various chemical materials, including pollutants, and they transmit information to the interior of the cell from this external message. And what has been found in this study that was published recently in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, this volume 43 in year 2013, page 2686, is that substances that come from these modified food extracts that contain these non-celiac-related gluten sensitivity components are capable of activating and modulating the cannabinoid receptor type 2. This then is seen even in the peripheral blood mononuclear cells of children affected by autistic disorders. So you start saying, well, hold it, if those transmembrane receptors are sitting on the surface of gastrointestinal mucosal cells and they're also on the surface of peripheral blood mononuclear cells, we're starting to get a translation of that message into the immune system and a translation of that message then to other cell lines that have those same receptors, like the glial cells in the brain and modulation of function. So it may be that this is one of the targets for the active principles that come from these genetically unique individuals that pick up the message from these non-celiac gluten sensitivity components that then activate this immune system through these transmembrane receptors and start a cascade of events that ultimately seen clinically as conditions of altered neurologic and immunological function for which we find tidy diagnostic codes in order to reimburse for payment for diagnosis. So I think that it's a very interesting step forward in our understanding of how we connect mechanism of action with clinical observation and ultimately helping us better to define specificity for treatment. So this is a wonderful contribution of Dr. Fasano and his colleagues. Another similar contribution was a paper published in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders in 2012, in which they looked at the expression of caspases enhanced by these peripheral blood mononuclear cells in these autistic spectrum disordered patients, which again is related to the activation through these membrane receptors by specific types of activating substances that may associate themselves with non-celiac-related gluten sensitivity. So we're starting to see again this interesting connection. And I think that the last part of the story, the last of those on this list that I'm discussing, because this is going to be an evolving story, it's related again to another paper, in this case published in Pediatrics in 2012, volume 130, page 160, by Dr. Fasano and his colleagues. This one is entitled Gastrointestinal Conditions in Children with Autistic Spectrum Disorders, Developing a Research Agenda. And in this very important paper, they go back and they actually review what we had heard in previous issues going back more than 10 years in Functional Medicine Update, to the observations that Dr. Andrew Wakefield made as a pediatric gastroenterologist in England, in which he had been saying that there was this common thing of gastrointestinal lymphadenopathy in kids that had autistic spectrum disorders. Now, we got tied up all sorts of controversy about this as it related to immunization with MMR, but I'm going to move away from that just to talk about the anatomical and physiological connection by saying that maybe there is this altered immunological function seen in children associated with specific types of dietary exposures that then connects itself to neurological development and neurological function. And that's what this particular paper is about. In fact, they talk about this autistic spectrum disorder as a set of complex neurodevelopment disorders that are defined behaviorally, but they may tie back to altered immunological and neurological function that is associated with these GI-related issues. So I think this theme of cutting across disciplinary boundaries, looking at what I call systems biology approaches to the management of these difficulties, is at the frontier of the new medicine. It is actually transversing that of these altered boundaries between the gut and the liver and the brain and the immune system to say that these are part of systemic alterations in state function of the organism that in certain genetic uniquenesses can produce a wide cluster of outcomes. So I hope you took away from Dr. Fasano's extraordinary presentation what I did, and that is the gut is very important, the interrelationship of the diet to the gut, individualized to that person's own unique susceptibility and sensitivity, and that alterations in our food supply system can have profound and subtle effects over long-term health relationships. And we will extend this discussion into our next month's February issue with Dr. Gasparini, who I think you'll find drives this point home very, very beautifully. Thanks for being with us in our January EPIC 2014 issue.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis by Jeffrey Bland, LLC. Reproduction in any form other than for personal use is prohibited.